Welcome to the Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Chris Bajalian's The Jackal's Mistress is a historical novel set in the waning months of the American Civil War. In 1864, Libby Stedman, the wife of a Confederate officer imprisoned by Union forces, finds her life irrevocably altered when she discovers a gravely wounded Union captain, Jonathan Weybridge, left for dead near her home. Despite the profound risks, both personal and political, Libby makes the perilous decision to conceal and nurse the enemy soldier back to health. Assisted by her courageous niece and a formerly enslaved couple, Libby defies social conventions and wartime allegiances in a bid to preserve not only a life, but a sense of moral integrity. Chris Bajalian is the number one New York Times bestselling author of some 25 books, including The Princes of Las Vegas, The Lioness, Hour of the Witch, Midwives, and The Flight Attendant. The new novel is The Jackal's Mistress, and it's an absolute delight to welcome Chris Bajalian to the Book Show this week. Thank you very much. What a delight to have you here.
Joe, it is such a pleasure to be with you again. I love chatting with you. You are among the very best.
Well, thank you very much. Am I right at 25? Is this the 25th novel?
It is. It is. But even more impressive than the fact this is my 25th book is I just finished my 35th book tour. That is Iron Person triathlon stuff.
So how does that work?
We didn't do book tours for my first three books because they sold about 11 copies, always to people named Bajalian, and then there was a long period when I would do paperback book tours as well.
Did you enjoy talking about a book twice?
I do. It wasn't all that long ago that my book sold briskly, but only among people with my last name. I'm always so honored and flattered that there's any sign of human habitation at any of my events and people want to talk about books. And that's another thing that is so lovely is that even in 2025, there are still people who care about books. We still have this wonderful totemic connection to books, and I just love that.
I have to say that what I love about your work, you and I have talked about this in the past, but how varied the subjects you write about is insane. It's so different, and everything is different. Your last book was taking place in Vegas with a Diana impersonator, and here we are in the Civil War. That's a shift.
It is a shift. It is a shift. And I will confess that there are moments when I wish I would stay in one lane to it. I can't tell you how many people read one of my novels, such as a slow burn thriller like The Flight Attendant,
yep,
and really like it. And then they will pick up a book like Hour of the Witch, set in the 17th century and written in 17th century vernacular with a whole boatload of these, thous, and thys, and they will say, I didn't sign up for this. And they will be gravely disappointed. Likewise, somebody will read a novel like The Jackal's Mistress, historical fiction, third person omniscient, and they'll really love it. And then they will pick up a book like The Princess of Las Vegas, you know, cryptocurrency, gangsters, gunplay, and they're thinking, I thought he was kind of an intellectual.
Well, first of all, screw him.
There we go.
But I assume there's a reason for that, which is not only at the core, it would seem, varied interests.
It is varied interests. I will always write whatever is really fun for me in the morning when I come back from walking my dog. If I am not having fun writing it, then gosh knows no one is going to have fun reading it.
But the subject matter, is there ever a commercial sense to say, oh, it would be cool if I added to the canon of something in the Revolution or something that takes place in Scotland?
If I were to do that, it would not be for commercial reasons. I don't think I've ever told a story because I thought, this is going to sell whole pallets. It's not just that I have such profound integrity, because gosh knows I don't. I'd be happy to sell pallets. It's because I'm not sure my sensibility lends itself to continuing characters or to a book series. I don't think I have the attention span
The attention span part is interesting. I mean, that to me is fascinating because you're starting fresh every single solitary time, which creatively is amazing. But I would think you would say, especially, God forbid, you fall in love with one of these characters and say, I want to write more about them.
If I ever fell in love with a character so much that I wanted to write more about him, her, or they, I would probably have to kill them off at the end of a book.
Really?
To prevent myself from doing it. I wouldn't even want that temptation. And again, it's not about integrity. It's literally about what gets me excited. And you talked about varied interests. I was so excited. I will never forget how excited I was when I was having dinner at a dinner party and I was sitting next to a midwife and she started teasing me about the fact that my wife and I had gone 32 miles in the still of the night to the nearest hospital to have our daughter delivered. And she said, well, if you'd used me, this midwife said this, if you were to use me, you could have had Grace in your bedroom and you could have caught her. And I'd never heard the verb catch used in the context of birth. And I was fascinated, and I knew right then and there, I don't know what the book is, but oh my gosh, midwifery is so interesting. Or in the case of the flight attendant, I had just flown from Yerevan, Armenia on Aeroflot to New York City, and I was going to an Armenian restaurant to meet someone for dinner, and I was so captivated by three things, and they came together alchemically. The fact I'd had breakfast eight time zones away in Yerevan, Armenia. I was having dinner in New York City same day. I'd flown on Aeroflot, Russia. And, you know, this is before Ukraine. This is before the pandemic. This is like 2016. And Aeroflot, I was Aeroflot internationally back in the day was really good, but I'm thinking about Russia. And third, I'm in this bar. And I was looking at all these beautiful bottles of booze. And they came together alchemically with an idea of a flight attendant waking up far from home, a blackout drunk next to a dead body. And I grew obsessed with flight attendants. I had to know everything there was about the life of a flight attendant.
And how do you determine when you know everything you need to know about a flight attendant enough to write a book like The Flight Attendant?
Yeah. When you are tempted to have what we call information dumps. And all of you in the audience tonight know what an information dump is. You are reading the book and the narrative is moving along swimmingly and you care about the characters. And all of a sudden, the author shows how much they know about either a gun or a movie or the Titanic or pick a subject. But all of a sudden, you are thinking to yourself, well, gosh, didn't need to know that.
Chris Bajalian is our guest on the book show this week, and the new book is The Jackal's Mistress. So let us talk about the origin story of this book and what brought you to the Civil War with trails that lead us back to the state that we are recording in, Vermont.
The Jackal's Mistress had its origins in 2003 when a wonderful guy named Gary Sledge, who is an editor at Reader's Digest, called me up and said, I heard a story, an anecdote about a member of the Vermont Brigade and a rebel woman who may have saved his life. Any interest in researching it and writing about it? And when he said that what they knew about the story was probably in the Middlebury College archives, I was all in. And so I wrote the story. It appeared in the October 2003 issue of Reader's Digest, and this is the Reader's Digest condensed version. Henry Bedell of Westford, Vermont, loses much of his hand and one leg in a battle with Jubal Early's Confederates in the Shenandoah Valley in September 1864. He can't be moved to a regimental hospital behind the lines. General Sheridan is moving deeper into the valley, and he can't go with them. So he's left behind in an abandoned rebel farmhouse to die with Drew Gilblin Faust, would have called in the Republic of Suffering the good death. But he doesn't die. He is spotted by a formerly enslaved woman who works on an agrist mill with her husband, who is also now freed, and a rebel woman whose husband is a Confederate soldier captured at Gettysburg, God knows where in the Union prison system. The rebel woman makes the decision. If my husband were dying far from home in Maryland or Pennsylvania, I would want a Yankee woman, coarse as she might be, to keep him alive. And so, as you said so eloquently in your opening, Joe, despite the fact it is treasonous and dangerous, she makes the decision to hide him in her bedroom where no one would think to look for him because you would never go into a lady's bedroom. And there she nurses him back to health and then makes the decision that she needs to try to return him across the Union lines. I didn't think about this story for years after it ran in the magazine. Cut to 2022. I'm on the Lioness book tour. You must think my life is book tours. It's not. But I'm in Richmond, Virginia, on the Lioness book tour. And you feel the weight of the Civil War in Richmond, Virginia, in ways you do not in Vermont. I mean, you were just with Rick Atkinson. We are all about the Revolutionary War.
Right.
But the American Civil War, not so much. The closest thing Vermont had to a Civil War battle was when some Confederates came from Quebec into St. Albans hoping to rob a bank. They failed. No one was hurt. No money was even stolen. That was our Civil War. But in 2022 in Richmond, you feel the weight of history. It's only 2 years after George Floyd's murder and the statues of the treasonous Confederates finally taken down from Monument Avenue. And I thought about that story for the first time in 19 years. And it seemed to me, if ever we needed a novel about two decent people with wildly different political opinions, figuring it out and not killing each other, even though they are under one roof, it was now. So I did a really deep dive into the Shenandoah Valley, the Vermont Brigade, Civil War medicine, and I was off and running on the novel.
These differing ideologies under one roof, which is somewhat altered, if you will, because one of these individuals has saved the other individual's life, right? I mean, that's a huge part of it.
Yeah, that is huge.
You tend to be maybe a little more forgiving.
Yep. Nope, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. And you also just got it one other thing that was really important to me in The Jackal's Mistress. I wanted to reverse the tropes, and this was a great opportunity to do so. So instead of the guy on a horse who's the savior, you've got the woman who is really good with a Colt pistol, it turns out, and the man is entirely weakened and frail.
Yeah. You start off with a body count. That's cool.
You know, someone once said to me, whether it's historical fiction or thriller, if Bojalian wrote it, it begins with a corpse.
What is interesting about that to you?
You know, it's not the corpses or the cadavers, but maybe. You know, I realized in 2012, 2014, that I was in love with streaming, premium cable dramas, now streaming dramas. Shows like The Wire, The Sopranos, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, Succession, Homeland, The Americans. They're not always violent. Mad Men is not violent.
No.
But they're all about dread. And clearly, dread is my jam. And maybe that's why I begin with a body count.
Now, so another question I wanted to ask you, though, is when... Is you mentioned the medicine of procuring the medicine that is necessary to keep this soldier alive, and that is a fascinating trip that is taken to get the medicine where they almost get more than they bargain for, because they're told you're probably not going to get anything, and yet they come back with just a carriage filled with stuff.
And in real life, the model for Libby Stedman was a woman named Betty Van Meter, and with the formerly enslaved man who was running the grist mill with her, in real life a guy named Dick Runner, the two of them literally crossed rebel lines to the Union garrison at Harper's Ferry and went to the Sanitary Commission and managed to convince an officer there that they weren't Confederate smugglers in desperate need of medicine, that it really was for a Union soldier whose life they were trying to save. So they literally returned with an entire, what was called, Sanitary Commission medicine chest, filled with largely ineffective medicines, but Also, opium and booze. They brought back so much whiskey because whiskey was... It was a sedative, yes, thank you, and it was an antiseptic, as much as they understood antiseptics, and it was how they were going to bribe a rebel doctor not to tell anyone.
And the doctor was an alcoholic, so yes. There you go. That helps. You almost instantly, I found that I had a favorite character. Oh my God, I love this character. You want to guess?
Jubilee
is the greatest character in this. At 12 years old. Is the niece, and man is sassy and smart and has been on this earth longer than 12 years.
Joe, you're the best. I agree with you on all of that. Jubilee is my favorite character. She is sassy. She is smart. And this is why I love historical fiction. In real life, we know that there was a 10-year-old niece on the property. We do not even know her name, anything she ever said. We don't even know how she was directly related to the heroine in real life. We know nothing about this child. But the great thing about tweens is that they have no filter. They will say literally anything. And so whether it's Jubilee and the Jackal's Mistress or Marissa Dowling in The Princess of Las Vegas or Emily Shepard in Close Your Eyes, Hold Hands, I love having tween characters because they can call out the adults for their hypocrisy, and they will. And Jubilee doesn't merely christen my Vermonter Jonathan Weybridge, the Jackal. She often calls him out for his hypocrisy. And the other great thing about tweens is that they can be the messengers for the omniscient narrator without the omniscient narrator ever having to get preachy. That's the other thing I hate in a book more than information dumps. Preachy, omniscient narrators.
I thought the character was lovely because it just has this, just has such energy, but also there's great comic relief to it as well.
You're right. I hadn't thought of it in that way, but yeah, Jubilee does bring a lot of comic relief to the novel. I mean, she has grievances. She is the 12-year-old George Costanza.
Oh, yeah.
On Festivus.
Yeah, there's a lot of grievances.
And, you know, it begins with the fact that because her aunt, Libby Stedman, is going to put this blue belly abolitionist in her bedroom so that Libby's going to have to share a bedroom with Jubilee. Jubilee's furious. Already, her mother has died. Her father is God knows where in Petersburg. And all of a sudden, she doesn't even have a bedroom to herself. She's got to share it with her aunt so this dying Yankee captain can have her aunt's bedroom. She christens him the Jackal.
So give us a sense of the origin of that term and where that comes from.
I first came across it in terms, for purposes of this book, when Jubilee uses the term, and I don't remember the context, I'm going to raise the black flag, which means taking no prisoners. And in that same essay where I saw that, I saw a list of Southern terms for abominable people, and one of them was jackal, because you can't trust a jackal. And I loved the idea of this 12-year-old kid who's already telling her aunt that if, you know, anything happens, I'm raising the black flag and we are taking no prisoners, that if anyone is going to christen this guy a jackal, it's Jubilee.
When you are writing about slavery and this particular husband and wife who have been freed by the family, that is a fascinating aspect because almost all characters in the novel have to be told that these slaves have been freed, and yet everyone is keenly aware of what is possible and what could ultimately happen to them.
I love Joseph and Sally, the two formerly enslaved people, the couple who do so much to keep Weybridge alive and to protect Libby Stedman. In reality, we have no idea who freed Dick and Ginny Runner, the models for Joseph and Sally. We do not know whether it was somebody's grandfather, somebody's father, or the Confederate soldier himself. But I wanted Libby Stedman, my heroine in the novel, to really be alone except for these two. And one of the reasons why she is alone is that she's not from the northern part of the valley. She's from Charlottesville. And it is her husband in the novel who, soon after John Brown's insurrection, frees his slaves. So she is not liked by the white plantation owners around the grist mill. She has virtually no one who she can talk to except for Joseph and Sally. She is every bit the persona non grata as these two formerly enslaved people who are running the grist mill with her. And the irony, of course, is that they are providing so much flour to the Army of Northern Virginia.
That is an interesting aspect, too. There's the idea that they're supplying the flour and almost gives them somewhat of a pass, because otherwise it would be a lot more difficult for them to live where they live.
Yep. They're literally bartering their safety by grinding the flour.
Those of you listening, those of you in this room, I'm not going to say anything about the ending, but my God, this has a great ending. It's beautiful because it to me brought everything that you would want it to bring in an ending. And I'm curious as to, as much as you do this, of what it was like to play around to get it to that point where it was, in your mind, perfect in the sense that it's ready to go.
This might be too much information, but I love books that break my heart. There is nothing that I find more satisfying than to be somewhere in the woods with my beloved dog, listening to an audiobook, reaching the end, and all of a sudden my dog is looking up at me with great concern because I'm just weeping in the woods. I love it when a book does that to me. And I never know how my books are going to end when I begin them. I refer to this book sometimes as a Civil War Romeo and Juliet because I know that I knew even when I was starting this book that my two main characters were going to be very good friends, if not lovers, but they're married to other people, so I'm not quite sure how that's going to play out. When I am approaching the home stretch of the book, and it's all muscle memory, That's when I get to the moment where, okay, I'm not sure I'm capable of doing an absolutely happy ending, but how close to happy am I going to get?
I just learned of this while I was talking to you prior to us coming out, because this was just published. So we're recording this on the 4th of June, I believe. And there is a piece in the Washington Post, in which case you have taken your book, you have put it into AI and many different AI platforms, and then you ask it questions. And, well, go ahead.
Okay, I didn't put it into AI, into the 7 different AI models. The Washington Post did.
Okay, so they go and they do that. You're the judge.
I'm one of the judges, yes, along with their tech writer, Jeffrey Fowler, but I'm the principal judge.
Okay, and you ask it questions and then determining who got it right.
Yes.
What was that like for you to do that as an experiment on your work?
Given that I've taken a pretty strong stand against AI models illegally commandeering people's books and using them to train computers to write books. It's offensive, it's appalling, it's intellectual copyright infringement. So I went into this with some trepidation. But one of the things that Doubleday and I thought about when I agreed to do this is that already these 7 models have stolen some, I don't know if all of them have, but 11 of my books have been used without my permission to train artificial intelligence to write books. So I went into this with some trepidation, but they made clear that, well, they already know your work. So they're not going to learn more. We're not using it as a teaching tool. We're literally going to feed the book in, and then we're going to ask it questions. And I have mixed feelings about whether the human race has a future. On the one hand, the question that the AI, two of the AI models...
The interview just got longer.
Sorry. Okay. Reader's Digest condensed version. The two questions that were most interesting to me, I asked, how do you feel about the epilogue? And two of the 7 models nailed it. They said everything I would want a human being to say, and that's when I realized, oh, we're screwed. The robots are here. But very often these very same models that could answer that question could not get the facts straight. So one of the models, for example, has Jonathan Weybridge, who's just had a leg amputated, walking to Libby Stedman's house.
So you come out of that, yeah, with a feeling of doom. But let us just, the end here is that you're asking it questions, you grade the questions, and there were no A's, there were no B's.
Correct.
And there were no solid C's.
Correct.
So that's not that great.
No, it's not that, no. In June of 2025, the AI models are still C minus D plus students when it comes to literature. And they also, in the same article, wanted the AI models to try to explain Trump speeches, legal contracts, and a physics textbook. So, you know, of some physics papers. And each of the models were better at some things than others.
I'm sorry. I'm just a little jolted by trying to figure out Trump's speeches.
Yeah, the AI models were too.
Yes. Okay. It would take me AI to figure that out. The name of the book is The Jackal's Mistress. It is published by Doubleday. Chris Bajalian is the author. Thank you so much for being here. What a delight.
Oh, Joe, you're the best. I thank you.
Once again, Chris Bajalian's new novel is The Jackal's Mistress, published by Doubleday. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. Our thanks to Northshire Bookstores in Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York, northshire.com. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.